Alan Kring Productions, in association with the Emergent Light Studio, presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, for spring semester 2022. Today, Ethics Part 2. Again, as usual, before we do that, we will have a look at the numbers. Next week is review for the final, pretty much exclusively. Monday and Wednesday, I will do review. Then on Friday, I'm going to do one last kind of like comprehensive quiz. But I will make it so that it's not going to destroy you. I'm going to try to help you along a little bit so that you can see a little bit of the context, what the questions would look like on that final exam. Without trying to destroy you before you've had enough chance to study for it. But Monday and Wednesday are review for the final exam, primarily. And the one thing that I will be doing is I will tell you what I think that you should learn, know for the final exam. I'll just go through, know this, know this, know this. And then on Wednesday, I will expect you to be able to ask me questions about what will this be on. And I'll be as direct as I can. If it's not going to be on the final, I'll say, don't worry about that. Don't study that. Can you do this kind of a problem? And all that kind of stuff. And I'll do one of those on the board for you to make sure that you've got the skill set in order to get to the final exam and survive it. The final exam in this class is, again, on Wednesday at 7:50 in the morning. That's right. Come in your pajamas, for God's sake. No, don't come in your pajamas. Not those ugly things you wear. But it's going to be a little bit challenge for some to get up that hour. But there you go. Okay. Quickly now, the markets are in a really sour mood. I mean, this is a grouchy as heck mood. They're all up down. Interestingly, they're all down about the same amount. Now, the one way that I could interpret something odd like that is that investors are getting out of everything. They're just selling out, getting out of the equities, whatever it is. Fancy stock, big, large cap, little stock, Fortune 500 stock. They're just getting out of them, and they are, well, let's see where they're putting the money. Crude is down a little bit. It's still well above $100 a barrel, but it's been having kind of a crabby day as well. And one of the reasons we're not seeing the price of oil going up, which it would like to do, is, as I had said, there is an awful lot of cheating going on in the sanctions. Russia's getting its oil out just like nothing had ever happened to a lot of places. And it's cheating on the parts of countries that promised they wouldn't buy Russian stuff. It's also cheating on the part of Russia itself. Obviously, if it can change the flag on a tanker so that it is something nice instead of a Russian flag, they're going to do it, and the ports are going to not ask any questions. They're just going to take the oil. And so Russia will get plenty of revenue in. So the problem is that oil does want to move up in price, but with the supply conditions the way they are, they're pretty good supply for a world in which a lot of the oil should not be getting sold. So there you are. Gold and silver are both down pretty strongly. So investors are selling stocks, but they're not putting it into the metals. Going over here, the 10-year bond is barely down in yield, which means that the price has gone up just a smidgen. But that's not enough to explain where the money is going. Essentially, money is going out of equities, and it's going out of metals. It's not going into bonds. This is parking cash. In other words, everyone's getting their money off on the sidelines. I just pulled all of my investments out, and I've got them all in cash right now because I'm not going to try to be a fire pilot and guess which way this market is going to go. And that's basically sophisticated investors do that. That's part of what I meant by that managing your portfolio kind of thing. You shouldn't be buying and selling stocks all the time unless you're an idiot like me who's a speculator. But over a period of time, you are moving between portfolio that's mostly stocks and a little bit bonds, maybe a little tiny bit of cash, the other way. And so as time goes on, you're thinking to yourself, where should I have my money? And right now, it looks like I'm not the only one who thinks we should just get our money and put it into money and not bother with investments until we get a clearer picture of what's about to happen on the national stage and on the world stage. Going over, as you can see, the sentiment in London is the same right now. It is just, they're still open, and it's just diving right down now down in London. Nikkei never did find any solid ground through the whole day. And this is true. I was looking at a couple of quick looks at other stock markets around the world. And yeah, everyone seems to be wanting to get out and wait and see what's about to happen. There is concern, as I said, about the use of nuclear weapons in the Russia-Ukraine conflict. And that would be a very exciting thing. Now, here's something that's really worrying me, is we had the 5-7 that had righted itself, and we still had that 7-10-year leg that was going down. Now, look at it. It's gotten more severe. The six basis points dropped from the 7 to the 10, deepening the inversion. And now here we go again. We've got the 5-7-year leg that is flattening, and it's about to invert. So apparently we're going to get a repeat of the message, here comes a recession. So good times ahead. And that is a good reason why investors are pulling their money out and waiting to see what in the world is going to happen next in the markets. So good news is always on the horizon. I was just at a department meeting, the finance department meeting, where we try to figure out where we are, where we're going, how do we recruit more students into finance, bring them to the dark side, and all of that. And we pretty much concluded that sometimes it's not that easy to recruit for finance because it sounds like it's a hard field. And for another thing, it sounds like it's a boring field, too. And I brought that up, and everyone kind of scowled at me, but you know, it does have its interesting side. We talk a lot about the world and the world stage in finance. And in the lecture that I'm going to give you today, which finishes the topic of ethics, and I should again point out, I'm going to open up a PowerPoint presentation. It's called The Agency Dilemma. And it goes through everything that I'm going through in this class, in this lecture especially, talking about how this integrates into business management and how it has to do so critically with finance. It culminates in a term called fiduciary duty, which is kind of tossed around, and you will be held to fiduciary duty in some of your relationships. And it's never really defined for you except here in my classes in FIL 240. So we're going to get to that here in a little bit. But going back to what I had said before about how I used to think that some things were taught in your business law class, your legal environment of business class, and I found out they weren't. One thing that I found out was not a heavily emphasized subject. It's talked about a lot, but it's not defined very clearly. Is some terminology that is legal terminology, but it has very specific implications in the problems of finance and in problems in business in general. One thing that I mentioned earlier in the course is the term person. A person is any entity that is recognized as separate in its own way under the law. So a person could be you. You're a person, an individual. But it could also be a partnership. That's a person. It is an individual. That thing is a separate entity and is treated as a unified thing under the law. There are other persons under the law. A corporation is a person under the law. This created a major problem, and I mentioned this earlier, is that the Supreme Court of the United States, some years back, there's been this slippage of treating companies and corporations specifically more and more like people, humans, giving them rights under the Constitution, saying, well, a corporation has the right of free speech, things like that. Well, it came to a big head in a decision maybe more than a decade ago when the Supreme Court said, well, it's a corporation is a person. The Constitution protects these activities of a person, including contributions to campaigns. And so they said corporations are allowed to contribute as much as they want to any political campaign they wish to because they are a person and the Constitution protects persons. And I'm pretty sure that the Founding Fathers did not intend for the word person or people in the Constitution to be treated that way, but here we are. For our purposes, understand that when there is an identifiable person, what I'm going to show here applies. Now, I have to go through, and this is a little bit tedious, and it doesn't take long, though. I won't go into all the detail. A contract. A contract is a type of agreement. Now, there are many agreements that aren't contracts. They might be quasi-contracts, but they are not contracts. A contract specifically has to meet four specific pillars. Now, some law books will say three. There's one guy who says 12. Four is a good. A contract must include an offer and an acceptance. No question about that. There has to be a serious offer made. Can't be a frivolous offer, although you've got to be careful. Sometimes what sounds like a frivolous offer can actually meet this line in a contract. And there has to be an acceptance. I accept this. So, for example, you, sir, I am a server at McDonald's, and you walk in and I say, may I McHelp you McPlease? And you say, why McYes? I would McLike, and you say, I would McLike that that cheeseburger on the menu. I say, well, certainly, McSir, and I prepare the cheeseburger for you. Now, did McDonald's offer you a cheeseburger and you accept the offer? The answer under the law, believe it or not, and that's why it sounds like that's exactly, absolutely not. In fact, an advertisement is not an offer. And that's why you've got to be careful. That's why advertisements can be vague. Only if they get really, really specific can it be an actual offer. Otherwise, it's just giving you an opportunity to make an offer. When you said, I would McLike that McCheeseburger, that was the offer to me. And when I said, well, McYes, that was the acceptance of your offer. So you always want to be a little bit vague in your advertising. Why wasn't that an offer when McDonald's put that up? It didn't tell you how many. It didn't tell you when. It didn't tell you anything that would be specific enough to make it an actual offer. Only when you said, I would McLike this, and you gave them a number, a specific value, then that was the offer. And then I accepted by doing what I did with it. Okay, now offers don't have to, they can be implied and all that. Now, you have a car, madam, that you would like to sell me. And you are offering me $5,000. You actually have an offer. I shall sell you this car for $5,000. And I say, I will pay you $4,000. As soon as I've said that counter offer, I have killed your offer. Your offer no longer is there. And you say, no, I will not accept $4,000. What that means, okay, I'll take your offer of $5,000. No, you can't. You actually cannot because the offer was killed by the counteroffer. When I counteroffered, a counteroffer kills an offer. Now, if you say, I will accept, I am offering you $5,000, and then you say, I shall accept the $5,000, that would be the ceiling of the first one. It sounds confusing. You have to think about it for a while, but it's very important for us in business to understand the difference between the offer, the acceptance, and a counteroffer. A counteroffer kills an offer immediately, right there, under American common law. Okay, the second one is that there has to be mutual exchange of value. Mutual exchange of value. Value for value. I gave you an engagement ring. And you took the engagement ring, so yeah, we're married. We're going to get married. No, we're not. Because that was a gift. You did not make any agreement with me regarding what this was for. A gift does not create a contract under any circumstances. Look, you're my kid. Okay, I gave you $1,000. So I expect you to mow that damn lawn. You know, the hell, you just gave me $1,000. Thanks, Dad. Bye, asshole. You see, there's no contract there. There was no offer and acceptance. A gift is not an offer. A gift is not, and you taking it is not an acceptance under any circumstances whatsoever. So you know that one. Now, I'll bet you haven't been told a lot of this yet. And, I don't know it, so it doesn't apply to me. Remember what I said about constructive knowledge? You could know about this. The third one is capacity. Now, this one is a little bit tricky. Generally speaking, under the law, being drunk does not invalidate a contract. A contract is not voidable just because you were drunk when you signed it. Use a great example of this. Two couples many years ago were having their usual Friday night drinking session together at the one guy's house. And when they were sufficiently drunk, this one guy was bitching about how ugly his house was. I'll sell that house to you for $1. It's such a crap. The other guy said, okay, yeah, sure, I'll take it. So he signs it on a napkin. I hereby sell this house for $1 to you. La, 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 ha, ha, ha. And the other guy said, okay, I got my... So the next day when they were sober, the guy comes over and says, here's $1, I want my house. You can't have my house, that was a joke. What the hell? Well, I'm sorry, the drunkenness did not impair the capacity. Generally speaking, now this does not regard some areas of law like sexual abuse and all of that, where you can get someone drunk and then do whatever. That's not what this is about. This is about contracts. But in general, what was even worse was it was in writing. Know this, though, that a written contract is no higher quality in general than an oral contract. A written contract, one of the things about a written contract is what's called the parole evidence rule, Four Corners Doctrine. If you've got a written contract, only what is in the four corners of that written contract applies. Nothing else applies. Well, we talked about this other term. Doesn't matter. It's not in there. I'm sorry. Whatever is in the document itself is all that matters. Now, an oral contract, you can have the he says, she says. But most of the contracts you will engage in your life, matter of fact, the vast majority of them will be oral contracts. The order of food at the McDonald's, that was an oral contract, and it was perfectly valid, and it was quite effective. So do know that. But anyway, back to capacity. An area that is difficult, there was a long time when people who had diminished capacity, as in Down syndrome or whatever, were forbidden from marriage because marriage is a contract. And they said, well, people with Down syndrome do not have the capacity to enter into contracts. Only in recent years has that been pushed to the side. No, they have plenty of capacity under many circumstances to engage in contracts. One place where there is a very difficult thing going on right now is with a contract and a minor, a person under the age of 18. Because technically, a contract cannot be formed with someone under the age of 18. And so if you sell I sell bubble gum to you, madam, and you are 17, you can chew the bubble gum, then take it out and put it back on the counter and say, I want it back. You can't do that. Well, yes, I can, because the contract is voidable, and I am hereby voiding it because I didn't have the capacity to enter into the contract. that nasty. Do not enter into contracts with people who are underaged. You're asking for a voidability of the contract because of lack of capacity. Seriously, that's a major problem, because there is an argument that is politically really unpopular now. Like, hell, they're not capable. I mean, you see these kids doing things that obviously they have capacity way beyond what we fantasize the capacity of a kid could be. But the law is very rigid on this point. Contracts capacity begins at 18. Now, that doesn't mean that the contract could not form and could not proceed, execute, and close, and everyone's happy. It's just that it is voidable because of the lack of capacity. So a contract can exist, but it can still be voidable at the discretion of one of the parties. So be careful there. And the last one is legality. Legality. You sold me a dime bag, man, and that wasn't even weed. That was herbs. That was rosemary and thyme. What the hell, man? I'm going to sue you. No, if you do that, you will be taken to court and sent to prison because it was not a legal agreement. It was an agreement, don't get me wrong, but it was not a contract, and therefore contract law does not apply, and a court would not recognize a suit under contract law in that regard. The same would go for any kind of illegal activity, drug sales, prostitution, and a lot of other things. It's not a contract at all, and you can't sue under it for violation of the for breach of contract. I put this in here because understand that in many circumstances, again, an oral contract, it has every bit the quality of a written contract. So you can have contracts that exist and you don't really even know that they exist. There are contracts that exist simply because the law says that a contract exists. There are contracts that exist simply because the custom of the country is that a contract exists. A friend of mine made the mistake. He was in Romania, and a street vendor, probably one of my ancestors, I have Roma in my ancestry more than I should, said, here's a rose. And the guy took it. Oh, nice. He said, okay, so now you owe me 100 euros for that rose. Because under that law, you see, as soon as you touch the object, you have agreed to the contract. I didn't do anything. Under our laws, yes, you did. I offered, you accepted. Contract closed. Now pay me the 100 euros. He was, needless to say, very upset, but the polizia came and explained to him, no, you pay him because otherwise you're in violation of the contract and we have to arrest you. Contracts exist when you go in, you sit down in a hair salon. By the way, you notice I got my hair done. Do I look good or what? I sat down there last night. You're like, really? And I sat down there, and she came over, and she said, come on back. And so she gave me a very, very handsome haircut. And so I could have walked out. Well, I didn't agree to anything here. I'm sorry. You know, I didn't say, yes, I'll pay you for a haircut. But I did. By going in there and sitting down, the customary understanding would be that I was offering, there was an offer and acceptance, legal, I had the capacity, and all of that mutual exchange, a service for a haircut, for money. So yeah, it was a perfectly valid contract, even though no one ever said, wherefore we have this contract. It doesn't have to be that way at all. So this is where we get down to issues in business, where you are in a matrix of contracts, some of which are written, which we do want, parole evidence rule, you know, the four corners doctrine, all that, but a number of them, they just exist. Now, the two big terms here, agent and principal. And that's P-A-L. The agent is a person charged with maximizing the welfare of another person. An agent is a person charged with maximizing the welfare, and that could mean wealth, whatever, happiness of another person. The principle is that other person. So if you are charged with maximizing the welfare, the wealth, the productivity, whatever, of another, you are the agent. The board of directors of a corporation is, notice I said is, not are, is. The board of directors is a person under the law. No matter how many there are, it's a person. They are charged, or I just did it myself, it is charged with maximizing the wealth of the shareholders. That is its charge. The board of directors is the agent, and the shareholders as a body is the principal. Where the hell did I put my phone? Okay. Agent and principal. Now, a lot of them are very clear. Let's try a doctor and a patient and his patient. Who is the agent and who is the principal in this in that relationship? In a doctor-patient relationship? I was expecting you to get it wrong because most people get it wrong. You're absolutely right. The doctor is charged with maximizing the health of the patient who is the principal. Very good. And then the same with attorney and client. The lawyer is the agent. The client is the principal. The lawyer is charged with maximizing the welfare, perhaps the freedom of the principal. Let's try this one. A parent and a child. Let me try this with you, ma'am. Who is the agent and who is the principal in a parent-child relationship? Excellent. Because the parent is charged with maximizing the welfare of the child. Seems odd. The child is the principal and the parent is the agent. Now here's one. I'm going to try this on you, sir. In a marriage, who is the agent, husband and wife? Who is the agent and who is the principal? And I caution you, son, you could get hurt saying the wrong thing. Who is the agent and who is the principal in a marriage? Nope, you can't be both. You can't be agent and principal. You were almost on the right track there. Okay, let me try. Who would you say is the agent and who is the principal in a marriage?
I would say the husband is the agent.
You would, wouldn't you? Okay, here's the truth of it. The husband and the wife are both the agents. The marriage is the principal. Remember, a principal or an agent doesn't have to be a human. They are both charged with maximizing the welfare of the principal, which is the marriage itself. There is the problem, is that in that case, and this would be the same thing with a soldier in the military. We swore an oath to the Constitution of the United States. The soldier is there to maximize the welfare, the survivability, and the strength of the Constitution of the United States defining the Republic. And to put it in blunt terms, many years ago, a president was alleged to have said the Constitution is nothing but, quote, a goddamn piece of paper. And everyone was shocked that he would say something like that. In fact, he was absolutely right. The only reason the Constitution has life is through the agents who maximize its welfare. The agents who are the soldiers, the agents who are the citizens. All of us are the agents maximizing the welfare of our nation as citizens and soldiers. So that takes us to into a fascinating realm, that this, what I'm going through here, agency, is a broad understanding, and it is in common law. The ancient law that carries underneath all of the written laws is this ancient tribal law we call common law that carries with it the strength of the bindings among people. Law itself comes from an ancient word that was the base language of many of the languages of the world, a language called Proto-Indo-European. We hear it in all these different words. Lex, law. Law, ligature, ligament, all these bindings of people together. This is how we bind, is through the contracts. Oral, written, whatever. Implied by law, implied by fact, whatever. This is where it all begins. And in our world, in business, we have to recognize this every day that we function. Here's the problem, though, and this isn't just in business. Let me give you an example. The parent-child relationship. The parent is the agent who is charged with maximizing the welfare of his children. So that means, and here's a typical night when you get older and you have kids. You come staggering in, you're tired, you're worn out, you're just exhausted, you flop down in your chair. Oh, God. And there are your kids going crazy, bouncing up and down on the couch, swinging from the chandeliers, climbing the walls, doing all kinds of mayhem. Now, what you should do as the principal, or rather as the agent, is just take those kids and come on, let's give us a huggy. Let me fix you a nice, nutritious meal, and then, you know, we'll give you your baths, and I'll read bookies to you. I love you so much. Maximize their welfare. Well, here's what you're going to do. Oh, God, you kids, stop it. You quit it. Here, take my belt. Beat yourself. But you're bad. That's what you're going to do. Here, I'm going to fix you some nuke and puke, and then you go wash your face and crawl into bed. Damn it. You're going to do that instead of what you should do. Agents have an incentive to maximize their own welfare instead of the principal's. That is called the agency dilemma. Agency dilemma. An agent always has incentive to maximize its own welfare instead of the principles. That is the agency dilemma. In other words, I trust you. You're not going to screw me over. You're going to do everything right. You're my agent. Yeah. No, I can't do that. You cannot do that. That is irrational. You must assume whether or not the agent really is a good person or a bad person. You cannot make an assumption. You have to understand that the agent has an incentive, always has an incentive to maximize its own welfare. We must bring this down to numbers, though, in finance, in business. Before I do that, though, understand that in a normal agency, the principal is responsible for monitoring and enforcement of the contract with the agent. That's that vicarious liability that I talked about before. It's the principal's duty, not the agent. The agent has an incentive to screw up, but it is the principal's job to make sure that does not happen in a normal agency relationship. And I'll tell you the exception here in a few minutes. long time ago, in my early years as a consultant, I had a gig up in upstate New York, bringing together some capital for a slaughterhouse butcher shop that was operating up there. It was actually, it was a decent-sized operation. Had about 42 people that were working there, and they really didn't do the slaughterhouse part, but they did the butchering of the meats when they had finished bleeding out and all of that. And so the problem that they were having was that they needed the money to get a surveillance system, CCTV cameras, because they were just bleeding theft from the employees. The jokes were that guys would come in with short sleeve shirts on and leave with long sleeve shirts, and they had big muscles. They were wrapping stakes around their arms. You know, the ladies would come in skinny, and they'd leave with a belly because they were hiding a roast under it. It was just one of those things where, yeah, there was a lot of theft going on. And so they wanted the money to get a CCTV system for the floors of the for the cutting floors, and for the hallways, and for the parking lot. Here's the problem, though, is they had not thought it through clearly. You don't have to just buy a CCTV system. You're going to have trained people, security, watching the monitors at all times, and then, okay, there's your monitoring all the time, watching your employees, and then what happens if you see someone walk out into the parking lot and you suspect that that person is hiding a roast under her shirt? Are you really going to take the chance on the liability from searching that person? Really? Yeah, have you thought this through at all, what this is going to cost in terms of liability insurance, in terms of employee costs for security guards and all of that kind of stuff? Monitoring and enforcement can be a terribly expensive thing. Are you really going to save enough money to make it worth this? Net present value of the project and all that kind of stuff. Replacement. Replace no system with an expensive system. Fortunately, a young man, he was the son of one of the founders, came up with an idea, and he brought it up. He said, why don't, instead of we doing all of this monitoring enforcement, why don't we just have Free Meat Fridays? On Fridays, all of the employees can take home 5 pounds of whatever meat they want. Steaks, ground beef, roast, whatever. Just every Friday. And at first there was, oh, that's ridiculous. And finally it took hold at that meeting. You saw more people getting on board. And I'll be darned if that didn't work. The theft went down. You turned an illegal agency act into a legitimate benefit of working there. And the cost went down because people weren't constantly trying to steal food and all that. They knew on Fridays they'd get meat for the weekend and maybe enough for a few days into the week. So you have to think about monitoring and enforcement. What's the marginal cost of greater monitoring and enforcement? And you have to do both. You can't do just one. Versus what is the marginal benefit that you're going to get from it? So it's a balancing act, this part right here. Now, in finance, as I have said on more than one occasion, we need to get from fuzzy words to money numbers. Tell me how much this costs in terms of agency. So in other words, when we're talking about agency dilemma and these maximizing their own welfare, the agents are, we have to liquidate that down to agency costs, and there are 5 of them. The first one is perquisites, what are oftentimes called perks. These are wrongful benefits as a result of position. Wrongful benefits as a result of position. This is the CEO who has a desk that's so large you could land a small plane on it. This is the give you a good example. Years back, I was at a dinner with these executives, and they said, you know, why don't you quit teaching? You're not making anything there. You can become our new comptroller. We need one. I said, you don't want me to do that. Because you guys take trips first class to all of your meetings. You don't need to do that. Greyhound goes everywhere. And you're staying at five-star hotels. Come on. You don't need to do that. Motel 6, it works. And you even have that quarter machine to make you happy. And these five-star restaurants, for God's sake, Denny's has Grand Slams for $3.99. Back then they were. And they did, of course, they thought that was hilarious. And I was being dead serious. You're taking benefits. That is the shareholders' money, for God's sake. Why are you using it for yourself? Oh, it's because you can do that. Even though the principals, the shareholders, are damaged by you doing that, and these massive salaries that are paid, we have tons of evidence that above a certain salary that's well under $1 million, you get no more productivity out of any worker whatsoever. You just don't get it. So when you pay yourself these massive salaries, that shareholder money, that's a perk. You don't need it. It doesn't benefit the corporation. It benefits you, cupcake. That's perks. Now, here's another one, shirking an agency cost. Avoiding your duties as an agent. Shirking, avoiding your duties as an agent. This is the employee who wanders from one cubicle to the other, chatting everyone up during the day, doing all those kind of fun things, and the extra few minutes on the smoke break or the lunch break and all that kind of stuff. Shirking is an amazingly costly problem. Long ago, I was at another dinner, and there was this kind of upper-level manager, and they were talking about workload, and he said, I make sure my desk is clean every night. I get it all taken care of so I can go home with a clear desk. And then, of course, I was hearing from the others, yeah, that's because at the end of the day, he takes all of his work and he puts it on his subordinates' desks. Shirking. Yeah, every night he does that. I was consulting for one company long, long ago, and there was this one account executive. Every morning he'd show up at the right time, 8 o'clock, and he'd walk past the receptionist's desk, grab the Wall Street Journal, and he'd go into the men's toilet, and he would be there 45 minutes every day. It was like clockwork. That man had the most regular bowels you could imagine. Shirking. He didn't have to work. He was on a toilet taking a crap. Every morning, that's shirking. Shirking has all kinds of different aspects to it, but it's avoiding your duties as an agent. The next one, direct theft, just stealing. The employee who sneaks out from a retail establishment with a nice shirt or something like that. The professor who grabs a few extra markers just because he has a whiteboard at home that his kids like. That's theft. It's stealing. It's huge. It's a massive multi-billion-dollar problem. And, of course, these companies are always saying, our employees steal so much. Yeah, well, look at the perks and look at the shirking and tell me that they are the real problem. I mean, they're all agents, and they're all extracting their own agency costs. It's just the reality of it. Number four, lying. Avoiding responsibility by assigning it to someone else or just saying it didn't happen. Lying is an enormous problem. It causes extraordinary costs because, first of all, the lying deflects solutions while blame is going around. It also demoralizes the people who are always the whipping boys of the liars in corporations. It is a real cost, and it is really nasty. It is a continuing problem in corporations. And finally, there's one that is fascinating. It's called, okay. Have you ever worked in a place where one of your coworkers was dumb as a box of rocks? I mean, that's even disrespecting rocks. The person was so stupid. Incompetence is a major problem. In fact, what's even worse is that incompetence isn't a bug, it is a feature. Know this, that every employee, every agent is either on his or her way to incompetence or has made it there. Think about it this way. You, madam, I hired you, and it's just like you did everything incredibly well. I mean, you're just an awesome employee. So, meritocracy, you're promoted, and you do great there, as in the finance department. Obviously, you change your major to finance. And so, you go up the line, and then finally one day, the CFO of the company comes swooshing in. Ba, 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 ba. You have impressed me, and I would like to have you become the assistant chief financial officer. You will get a raise to $500,000 a year plus bonuses. You will also get a company car and keys to the executive washroom. What say you? Join me or die. You know you can't do that job. There's no way you can do it. That's not even what you want to do with your life. Are you going to say no? Remember. You see, you're probably going to say yes. See, rise to your level of incompetence. This isn't just, there was a professor many years ago, a management guru named Dr. Peter, and it's called the Peter Principle. At the time, it was thought that he was being funny. We know now that was, it's not. This is a process. You will rise up. Look at the head football coaches. Most of them are incompetent AF, but they kept rising because they were good as assistant coaches. CEOs of corporations generally are absolute idiots in that position, but they rose there because they were so good that they kept going up the chain. That's incompetence. This is what you face. This is the framework I was talking about yesterday. It sounds evil and cruel, but this is where it breaks down to. You manage the agency costs. That's your job. You are going to have the college degrees. You're going to be the managers. You are going to have people under you, and you're also going to have people over you. These agents are going to try. You have to assume that they are going to extract agency costs. Whether or not they do, well, this could be some fine, upstanding young man right there. I don't think you do anything wrong. That's the wrong attitude. I must assume that you will and put the controls in place so that you won't do that. This whole framework has one exception. It is so important, I can't believe that it is not emphasized anywhere else in the College of Business. There are times when the principal cannot monitor and enforce. The principal doesn't have that ability. Like a child. A child, the principal, he or she doesn't know what the parents should do. A doctor, when you're under anesthetic, you don't know what the doctor's doing, even though he's the agent. You're the principal. It's your responsibility to monitor and enforce. You can't. A lawyer is the principal of the client, but the client doesn't know the law. The lawyer does. In those kinds of relationships where the principal cannot monitor and enforce, we say that it is a fiduciary relationship. A fiduciary. The agent must behave as if the principal. Black's Law Dictionary defines fiduciary duty as the highest duty implied by law. That carries massive weight. Highest means there isn't anything else. And there's not highest here, highest there, we'll take them both. No. And implied means that it is older than written law. Laws can say fiduciary duty, but fiduciary duty carries back to the tribal law, to the law of the bindings of people together, to the code of the knights, to the honor of the people who are the citizens of the country. No law can say this. Fiduciary duty is characterized by trust, loyalty, and fidelity. Fidelity means faithfulness. These are its characteristics in a fiduciary relationship. But as I said, and this is the final point, you can't have the highest here and the highest there. You have to, there's no such thing as, well, they're both highest, but this one's higher now, this one's higher here. You can't do that. I'll tell you a good example, the greatest story I have. I was the CEO of a small corporation. I had the highest duty. Because the shareholders couldn't monitor and enforce, I had to carry it myself as the fiduciary to carry out maximizing their welfare. But then I also had a family, wife and kids. They are a highest, they are a fiduciary. They cannot monitor and enforce me, so I must do it myself as their agent. And therefore, I was carrying highest and highest. And you know what? One night, I had worked really hard, gotten everything together so that the financials could be published in. So I had fulfilled my fiduciary duty to my corporation, to my shareholders. And so there I could go home and see what I could do for my fiduciary duty to my family. The house was dark. It seemed that I couldn't really carry two fiduciary duties at the same time. My family was gone. Choose your fiduciary relationships carefully and know what is the most important in your life. That's all I have for you. Go home.